From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the crisis in Libya as the UN is set to meet on the issue. Iraq warns ISIS may be trafficking human organs. We'll examine a new face in warfare.
iGuerrillas organized as a virtual network. They don't have to see each other. They don't have to be in the same group or even in the same city.
And humanitarian aid reportedly unable to reach millions in Syria. I'm Susan Yawkey. The UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting today on the security situation in Libya, following the release of a video Sunday showing the mass beheadings of Egyptian Christians by militants of the Islamic State in Libya. The Egyptian government, which launched airstrikes in retaliation, has called for a Security Council resolution aimed at international military intervention. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi told France's Europe One Radio Tuesday the 2011 NATO air campaign launched to aid rebels seeking to oust dictator Muammar Gaddafi represented an unfinished mission. He said, "We abandoned the Libyan people as prisoners to extremist militia once Gaddafi was removed and killed." Tuesday, the United States joined five European countries in condemning all acts of terrorism in Libya, saying it underscores the urgent need for a political resolution to the conflict in Libya. It says a UN-sponsored process to establish a national unity government is the best hope for Libyans to address the terrorist threat and confront the violence and instability that impedes Libya's political transition and development. Ian Lustick, a political science professor and Mideast analyst at the University of Pennsylvania, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is no military solution to the Libyan conflict.
One thing I don't think they're going to be able to do is get a resolution that will approve any kind of UN military intervention in Libya. That's something that the Russians will just not allow, and I don't think that you'll find the British or the EU very interested in engaging in it either, though I understand France has been in contact with Egypt. I think we have to step back for a minute and not plunge immediately into what always seems to be most interesting in these situations, which is exactly what kind of military action will or will not take place, and see the way that the local players, in this case Sisi and Egypt, are in a position to wag the dog, to use something that they know the world cares about tremendously, namely the ISIS threat to Europe, and to position Egypt in the front lines of what they would see as a renewed war on terror, in which Sisi's own problems in Egypt can be solved because he could get lots of money and political support from the West. That's what's on his mind, in addition to whatever specific threats there are in Egypt. So I think we have to be careful about being manipulated by the Egyptians in this case.
There was a joint statement released by the governments of the U.S., France, Italy, Germany, Spain, the United Kingdom, strongly condemn the acts of terror in Libya, underscores what they say is, quote, the urgent need for a political resolution to the conflict in Libya. As you probably know, that there are UN-mediated indirect talks among the various factions in Libya. Is that the best way to go?
There is no really good way to go, and that's the best one. But I am one of those observers that doesn't hold very high hopes for UN-mediated talks in Libya. If they couldn't work in Syria very well, in Libya the situation is much, much more difficult. There is no Libyan state anymore. You have two rival governments, three or four sections of the country that could split apart, tribes and militias galore throughout the country. We succumb to a temptation to help one side win the war, namely the anti-Qaddafists. We broke Libya without putting enough resources into it afterwards to try to fix it. And I think that's what the administration is regretting now, walking away too soon after NATO went in and produced what Qaddafi predicted. He said, you will get rid of me and there will be hell here. There'll be chaos. And that's because he purposely arranged it that way. And there was no real state in Libya. Now, that's something which was not taken seriously by the West when it pushed ahead in Libya. Now, in a world that's even messier, where the Russians have reasons in Ukraine to keep us tied down, busy, and aggravated in North Africa and in the Middle and in the Levant, we have even fewer resources in terms of the UN. Yes, we have UN mediators, but no hope, really, I think, of UN-approved intervention.
Lustig suggests the likely future of Libya is partition between East and West, similar to what occurred in Somalia, but with the added concern that it possesses oil and is closer to Europe. Iraq's U.N. ambassador warns that Islamic State militants may be trafficking human organs to help fund their campaign of terror. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
In a briefing to the U.N. Security Council, Ambassador Mohammed Ali al-Hakim said Islamic State is carrying out the most serious of crimes against Iraqi people of all ethnic and religious backgrounds. He's heard here through an interpreter.
These are, in fact, crimes of genocide committed against humanity that must be held accountable before international justice.
Many of the crimes of the Islamic State have been well documented, often by the group itself. In a shocking new allegation, al-Hakim says he has reports of IS militants dealing in human organs. The Iraqi ambassador told reporters that the government discovered evidence of the possible organ trafficking in recent weeks in shallow mass graves containing between 10 and 20 bodies each.
When we discover mass graves, we look at the bodies. Some of those bodies are killed by bullets, some of them by knives. But when you find pieces of the back is being missing and kidneys is missing, and you will wonder what it is.
He said Islamic State has access to airports in Mosul and in the Syrian city of Aleppo from which it could transport the illicit organs out to international middlemen and buyers. The envoy also alleged that in recent weeks, Islamic State militants have executed at least a dozen doctors in the city of Mosul because they refused to remove organs from victims. The UN's top envoy to Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov, said his office has seen the reports about the organ trafficking but could not confirm them without further investigation. Such reports are difficult to confirm, especially with a third of Iraq's territory in the hands of the militants. Similar claims were raised 5 years ago related to possible organ trafficking during the Balkan War in the late 1990s. Allegations were made that the Kosovo Liberation Army ran detention centers along Albania's border with Kosovo, where captives, including Serbs, were killed and their organs sold on the black market. Those allegations have never been proved. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
John Sutherland, a senior analyst with the Department of Defense and author, examines a new face of war. It's the eye gorilla. We asked him what that is.
What the eye gorilla is a new technologically competent insurgent. Really kind of the way I think about it is all the way up until 2000, when I thought about gorillas, I would think of like Che Guevara and his band of gorillas running around the backwoods of Bolivia wearing worn-out old fatigues and carrying AK-47s. Not very technically competent, not a lot of good equipment with them, and they eventually were hunted down and defeated not really too hard. The modern eye gorilla is much better equipped, and they're technically competent. It's a generational thing. When I thought of the term eye gorilla, it was kind of like iPod, iPad, you know, iPhone, because it's the younger generation that are competent with the new social media, and they put all these things to work. And so when you see eye gorillas now, like, say, the Islamic State, these guys aren't wearing, you know, worn-out old stuff. They're in Gucci new ninja outfits and carrying top-of-the-line equipment. And it's all because they've exploited the post-Cold War globalization situation.
How does this change the way we have conflicts in the world?
Well, it makes the perhaps the most important thing that I've noticed about them is gorillas in the past were not very adaptive. They pretty much had their set way of doing things. But today's gorillas, they adapt and innovate and change with the forces that are opposing them. And the reason this was is because back in the old days, gorillas had to form in physical cells. If you take, like, the Algerian gorillas that fought the French back in the 50s, a cell would form with a small number of folks in it. They would have a certain mission, and they would know each other in their cell and their boss. And their boss would know the next guy in the chain of command, and that was it. So the whole insurgency was compartmentalized, and it helped them to survive. But as you rolled up a cell, if you could get the boss to link you to the next cell, you could roll the thing up gradually, which is how the French defeated them. Well, eye gorillas organized as a virtual network. They don't have to see each other. They don't have to be in the same group or even in the same city. So they can actually share their lessons learned. When something goes well, they can spread the news on what worked. And when something fails, they can spread that word as well. So a Chechen guerrilla can share a successful bombing technique with somebody in Libya who could share it with somebody in Iraq or Syria. And that makes them much more adaptive. So the fight is a lot more dynamic now.
Author and senior analyst with the Defense Department, John Sutherland. He stresses that his views are his own, not the government's. We plan on bringing you more of his remarks Thursday on International Edition.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Delegates attending a UN-sponsored meeting on the crisis in Syria have appealed to all warring factions to allow humanitarian agencies to deliver desperately needed aid to millions of people who currently are out of reach. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Representatives from governments and major aid agencies are meeting this week to discuss the nuts and bolts of humanitarian operations in Syria, neighboring countries of refuge, and Iraq. The meeting, called by the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, is putting a particular focus on the increasingly dire situation faced by Syrian civilians, both inside and outside the country. Next month, Syria will enter its fifth year of war. The casualty toll is staggering, with an estimated 200,000 people killed, 7.6 million internally displaced, and more than 3.2 million refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt. Syria is considered the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with more than half of Syria's population of 12.2 million in need of assistance. Kelly Clements is Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. She says providing aid in this conflict-ridden country is extremely difficult and dangerous. She notes the most pressing problem is getting access to hundreds of thousands of needy people in areas that are essentially off-limits.
Nearly a 250,000 Syrians today are living in areas besieged by violence, and a large portion of them require food, supplies, and urgent medical care. The UN currently has no access to 600,000 people residing in ISIL-controlled Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, and most large NGOs have also ceased operations. 2.8 million of the 12.2 million that I mentioned earlier are in ISIL-controlled areas.
In addition, Clements notes the UN Relief and Works Agency has been unable to deliver aid for more than 2 months to some 18,000 Palestinians trapped in the Yarmouk refugee camp in Damascus. The United States is the single largest donor of humanitarian assistance in the Syrian crisis. It has provided more than $3 billion since the start of the conflict and has just announced an additional $125 million in humanitarian aid to the UN World Food Program, which feeds nearly 6 million Syrians inside the country and in neighboring countries of refuge every month. Kelly Clements tells VOA the number of victims created in so many different ways by the Syrian conflict is eye-popping. But she expresses some reservations about the almost obsessive emphasis placed upon numbers.
It's probably better to talk about people and the people that are behind the numbers, because we get a little numb by the numbers in terms of just the enormity of the humanitarian catastrophe on the ground right now. And I don't want to dizzy with numbers when it's really lives we're talking about. And the situation is getting worse by the day. And even though we're getting a lot of resources in there, we're not even close to meeting humanitarian need. And so the gap is growing very, very quickly. And the desperation by many even faster.
Kuwait will be hosting the third donor pledging conference for Syria next month. At that time, Clemens says, the United States will announce a substantial increase in the amount of money it plans to give for humanitarian assistance to Syrian war victims. She says Washington is calling on other governments to do the same. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New food security initiatives are being launched in Guinea, one of the country's hardest hit by the Ebola epidemic. The World Bank is investing $5 million to fund efforts by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the government of Guinea. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Ebola outbreak began in Guinea over a year ago. Since then, there have been over 3,100 cases and more than 2,000 deaths in the country. Vincent Martin is head of the FAO's Sub-Regional Resilience Hub for West Africa and is based in Dakar. He says there's been good news of late about the slowing of the outbreak.
There is a feeling of relief in some of these communities, although we know that the situation is still fragile and very volatile, and everybody has to keep the vigilance very, very high so that it doesn't flare up again.
Ebola caused a drop in food production in Guinea, but Martin says the ripple effect had greater consequences.
What was more important during the crisis was not so much the impact on the production per se, but the impact on the market chains, the impact on the trade, the loss of incomes of these families, of households that live on agricultural trade and commerce. And this is what has really affected these communities.
The food security efforts in rural Guinea are part of the FAO's Ebola response program.
This Ebola program has four main pillars. The first one is about social mobilization and sensitization. The second one is about boosting agricultural production. The third one is about increasing the resilience of vulnerable communities. And the fourth one is about coordination.
He says the program trains rural communities on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.
We will sensitize around 240,000 people to these prevention measures. The second component of this project in Guinea will be about boosting the agricultural production, improve seeds, fertilizers, farming equipment, so that they get ready for the next season and they are not hit again by another shock, let's say.
The Ebola response program also aims to increase job opportunities. About 2,000 young people will be supported by a cash for work project. The FAO cautions that communities will need time to recover from the shock of Ebola. However, it warns that if no action is taken now, nearly a half million people in Guinea could be food insecure 1 year from now. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Bad publicity about martial law, backpacker killings, and police shakedowns of foreigners have harmed Thailand's reputation as a tourist magnet in past months. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok reports, the tourism industry for 2015 is trying to attract more upscale visitors, as well as package tourists from China, who are spending more per day than other nationalities.
From the hawkers on the Phuket beach to the managers in five-star Bangkok hotels, about 1 in 10 Thais holds a job related to tourism. The sector suffered last year amid political tension with long-term street protests in Bangkok that culminated with a military coup. Martial law remains in effect. That and publicity overseas about tourists being victims of serious crimes on resort islands, police shaking down foreigners in the capital, and taxi drivers overcharging fares have combined to give many potential tourists second thoughts about visiting. At Bangkok's Dusit Thani Hotel, a five-star establishment dating back to 1970, General Manager Sukanya Janchu says the tourism sector has always managed to quickly bounce back from crises brought about by natural disasters, political troubles, or economic downturns.
We challenge with nearly all crises we have. We learn from that. It's one after the other. It's quite challenging, but we always able to manage it pretty well.
Known as the Land of Smiles, Thailand hopes to put a happy face on the sector again this year and greet 28 million visitors, which was the numerical goal last year. In 2014, the total number of actual visitors was 26 million. But the goal for 2015 is not just a numerical target. Varatorn Sirisatayawang, an analyst at the Kasakorn Research Center, says Thailand this year will try to move away from its image as a backpackers' haven.
If you look at the government agenda, we try to attract more quality tourists, more than quantity in many tourist destinations. We also have the place for the middle group to the high-end tourists who get all north in Chiang Mai. We have a hotel like 5-star up, and also the niche market, healthcare, spa, and things like that.
Sukanya Jancho, who is also the marketing and public relations chairperson for the Thai Hotels Association, says the transition upmarket is not going to be achieved quickly or easily.
To drive from mass one is quite a challenge, but I think it can be done. Maybe it takes longer time, but we have to start.
China is now the largest single source of visitors to Thailand. The Chinese are considered the best spenders per capita on a daily basis, but their growing influence is not without controversy. During this week's Chinese New Year period, with 90,000 visitors from China expected, many are receiving etiquette guides. The brochures explain how to behave in museums and at temples, encourage proper rules for driving, and warn against public property as toilets. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The Swiss subsidiary of British banking giant HSBC faces a new investigation for alleged money laundering. Geneva prosecutors searched the bank's offices following reports that helped clients evade millions of dollars of taxes. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Geneva prosecutors say they have opened a criminal investigation into HSBC Private Bank in Switzerland for aggravated money laundering. In a statement, they said the move comes after recent revelations involving the Geneva branch. Last week, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in Washington, D.C., and several media organizations reported HSBC Switzerland helped clients in more than 200 countries evade millions of dollars in taxes. The reports were based on files stolen by a former HSBC employee in 2007. They were given to French authorities, who shared them with other countries. Economics professor Tomasz Mikulski of HEC Business School in Paris notes HSBC's Swiss unit already faces probes by authorities in France and Argentina, among other countries. These latest allegations add to its problems.
Because it wasn't only passive tax evasion, that they kept money of people on their accounts without asking any questions. It was actually active encouragement of tax evasion, active money laundering, and also related with, for example, arms traders, drug dealers, dictators. So the affair is potentially much more serious.
In a statement Wednesday, HSBC Private Bank said it has cooperated with Swiss authorities since the data theft. In response to the reports last week, its CEO, Frank Amora, said it had shut down accounts of clients who did not meet its high standards. HSBC is not the first bank to come under scrutiny in recent years. U.S. authorities, for example, have fined several financial institutions, including Swiss banks UBS and Credit Suisse, for helping U.S. citizens evade taxes. Again, Tomasz Mikulski.
So I think this is also going to happen to HSBC in the sense that they're going to have to pay a lot of fines. A lot of people are going to be fired. Probably some may face criminal investigation.
Mikulski says the 2008 financial crisis has led to a tougher regulatory environment, and cash-strapped countries are paying greater attention to individual and corporate tax evaders. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A pinstripe suit worn by Prime Minister Narendra Modi during President Barack Obama's recent visit to India is being auctioned off after it became the center of controversy. The navy blue suit had the prime minister's name, Narendra Damodaras Modi, monogrammed in the pinstripes. Media reports estimated that it cost about $16,000. Opposition leaders slammed the prime minister for being self-obsessed and narcissistic. The suit is going to be auctioned off in Surat City in his home state of Gujarat, along with about 450 other items that Mr. Modi has received as gifts during his 9 months as prime minister. Thank you for joining us today for our international edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.